the answer. So that is a way of both a way of inquiry as well as a way of deciding whether you are heading in the right direction or not. Anyway, so there we are. So let us continue with the Noble Eightfold Paths of Venerable Mudita. Would you like to continue here?
Sure. Okay. Did we do the right livelihood already?
Already done. Yeah, yeah, okay. Next one.
So what's the next one? Right effort. Okay. Ajahn Brahm translates the right endeavor. I don't know if which one is right. No, both are right. So, right effort. So we have your effort of restrainment. You restrain your... what? Your bad mind states. You restrain of, I don't know, looking to the beautiful other ladies when you have a wife. You restrain as a monk, as a looking at beautiful sights and
look,
things.
Don't look too much in the mirror. Yeah, that's
right.
Yeah.
Especially if you look at, yeah, well, what to do? If you got it, you got it. Well, the next one is then abandon. So if you have a bad mind state, you can abandon them. So if you are angry, you're trying to put the effort of abandoning the bad mind states. What should I say about abandoning?
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Yeah. We need to move on. Ajahn Brahm said so. Okay, develop. Well, that's a good one. That's actually quite an important one. And that's what we do. We teach metta meditation often, teach compassion, all that. So try to develop good mind states. So if you're not very beautiful in the morning when you look at yourself in the mirror, what's wrong? It's not the looks. It's just you don't have enough metta. So try to have a loving kindness towards yourself. And that's one of the ones where we practice all the time. We're trying to keep at it. So try to develop good mind states. And then when you have those good mind states, try to maintain them. Keep at it. And there is different practices obviously do that, but those are the four ones. So restrain, abandon, develop, and maintain. Okay, mindfulness, right? Mindfulness. This is a bit of a difficult one, and actually I struggled to summarize this. And I was, luckily, I live with good monks like Ajahn Brahmali, so I talked to them this morning.
The pusher has arrived, thank you.
And he said that, Ajahn Brahmali was saying this morning, that with right mindfulness, it's quite difficult. There's mindfulness this and that, mindfulness that these days, and everybody's mindful. And but right mindfulness, actually, it's especially towards the end, it means meditation. So if you think about mindfulness as a meditation, you can get pretty far. In the beginning of the path, you could think about it as it's almost like it guides you. It monitors the function to oversee the cultivation of the path factor. So it's sort of overseer of the path factor, but it's actually, like Ajahn Brahmali, at the end, it's about meditation, really, samasati. And right stillness. Anybody know why we call this stillness? Samasamadhi? It's because Ajahn Brahm. Quite often, samasamadhi, if you look anywhere, Wikipedia, Bhikkhu Bodhi, translations everywhere, how do they translate? Concentration. We try to move away from concentration. We don't concentrate. We have stillness. And it's actually the good way of just look at it. It's just samasamadhi. Just say jhana or jhana meditation or, you know. So right, samasamadhi basically means jhana at the end. That's what it means. Yeah.
And we're going to talk later on about whether that is required or not, aren't we? That's next time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's
so
right.
That's kind of preview. So coming next time to a Buddha center near you.
Maybe we can leave this out. Maybe leave the right...
Maybe it isn't required. Yeah, it's a bit of a hassle with jhana stuff.
I know.
Yeah. Oh, well. Okay.
So let's move on.
Let's move on. And there's a question here from outside, but we'll take this later on when I'll just put it behind here a little bit.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's see. Oops.
That's your...
Okay. I just put it there. It's just something... there's maybe beginners, a lot of people, if you see this, this is the symbol for us Buddhists. You know, Christians have the cross and all that. We have the wheel. And why do we have the wheel? See, we have the 8 spokes on the wheel. Yeah, so that's the Eightfold Path. So that's what we have the...
And that wheel is found in the national flag of India.
Right.
Not much like a wheel. It's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is because that is part of the Ashokan pillars. Pillar. They have those wheels on them. That was taken into the Indian national flag. It's found that the Buddhist eight-factored wheel. It's kind of cool.
It is.
Yeah.
And I just put this one there because this is where the wheel comes from. But you see how there's like lead spokes? And quite often, actually, you see Buddhist wheels with many, many spokes, Ajahn Pramali. Have you seen? Like, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know.
But I never actually seen an eight-spoked cart wheel or something, but so interesting. Maybe they existed. But these were the carts of the time of the Buddha, so that's where we got the wheel rolling. And the Buddha is the sets the wheel rolling, so the path gets forgotten. It gets and the Buddha discovers the wheel and sets it rolling again. Okay. And beautiful saying from Dhammapada, the noble eightfold path is the best of all practices. This is the only path, not one path, only path for purifying insight. There is no other. Follow this path and you will discombobulate Mara. That's
who translated this one?
Yeah, who would translate it?
Ajahn Brahm, yeah, exactly right. Ajahn Brahm's translation.
It's basically there's interesting sometimes that some places where the monk dies. Actually, the monk killed himself in one of the suttas, and then there is the wrath. There's this black clouds going into the valleys, and the Buddha said, "Do you see monks? You see that black cloud? What is that? It's the Mara looking for that monk's mind." But he cannot find it. So you discombobulate the Mara. The Mara cannot find you once you come to the end of the Eightfold Path. Okay, 3 requirements. This, I think I'll go quickly because we are actually falling behind. So just summarized quickly, I borrowed this from Bhikkhu Bodhi. 3 requirements for the path. So it has to have a full and accurate picture of suffering, as we saw in the beginning from the Noble correct analysis. So you have to know what are the what is actually the causes, what causing the path, and it must have the means to eradicate the causes, a remedy, and it has to be verifiable by your own experience. So you have to know it really for yourself. So who knows it, whether you're in a path or not? You know it. Oh, okay. Gosh, I have a lot of... Closer to your end of the path, the more you disappear, right? So that's one of the no's. Like, we had the question, how do you know on the path? You're on the path? Well, you there is not so much of...
How can you be on the path if you disappear?
I don't know. You become like this.
You become like this. That's how you know.
You always have to have beautiful kittens somewhere there, so otherwise it gets too boring if it's just baking those. But so you're basically a just happy person. You're just happy to be there. We had in a discussion group, like some of the people said, they're like, whatever happens, you're okay with it. And the Buddha said that people argue with him, but he doesn't argue with the world. So you are like this little kid, and it's like, yeah, whatever happens.
You're saying that.
Okay, should we just keep moving? Because how far are we?
Read it out.
Okay, another beautiful simile.
Yeah.
There's a picture of actually Ganges I found online. Slanting east, the mendicants. And every time you see mendicants, you know it's Ajahn Pramali's. Oh, no.
Not me.
Ajahn Suchato's translation. So the original one is Bhikkhu. So Bhikkhu Bodhi translates monks, but you can do mendicants because it's monks and nuns. Mendicants, the Ganges River slants, slopes, and inclines to the east. In the same way, a mendicant who develops and cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path slants, slopes, and inclines to extinguishment to the Nibbana. Extinguishment. Yeah. That's a difficult word. So basically, if you just follow the path, you are going towards Nibbana. So good luck with everybody. Nice knowing you. You are going to go to the end. Okay, and here we go.
Okay. Okay. So, thank you. So, so when we get extinguished, you can't, you know, that's it.
That's it.
That's a good point.
Yeah. No more coming back, unfortunately.
Okay.
So it was nice knowing you.
Okay, so those are the eight factors, just in brief. And of course, we're going to discuss all of these factors in much more detail later on. But one of the things that each factor has, it has this prefix called samma, yeah? Samma ditti, samma sankappa, samma vacha. Every factor has samma in front of it. And samma is usually translated as right, and the opposite of samma is miccha. Miccha means like wrong, yeah? So I want to discuss very briefly what does it mean when we say it is right view, it is right speed. What does this word right or samma actually refer to? And there are some people who object to this, yeah, that there is such a thing as right. It's like we are the thought police and we tell you what is right and you have to be like this. And people who are a bit sort of anti-religious, yeah, who kind of think, yeah, but religion is just going to tell you what to do all the time. And they don't like this idea of right. So what exactly does it mean? And the first thing is that it is not really a command. It's not something that you have to do. Yeah, that is not the point of these things. Too many religions have doctrines, and you have to agree to the doctrines. And if you don't agree, then you are not part of that religion. And Buddhism isn't really like that. Buddhism instead has certain ideas that it presents as the truth. And then you can, you know, accept those or don't accept those. And if you don't accept any of them, then you're probably not a Buddhist. But it's kind of more like a movement or a practice or a trying to understand these things rather than a command to accept them. So right doesn't mean that you have to believe in these things. And if you don't, you're a bad Buddhist. That's not really what it means. So it's not a command. What it is, however, it is a way of seeing it is a right because it is in accordance with reality. That is perhaps one of the most important ways of thinking about this thing being right, yeah? Because they accord with reality. So when you talk about right view, it is, from the Buddhist point of view, from the Buddha's point of view, this is how the world works. And if you want to see the world the way it works, well, then that is when you have a right view. So the Buddha says, well, you know, this is what the Buddha does. He has an insight into reality. And then he says, well, listen, this is what I've seen. Now, you can take it on board if you want to, or you don't have to. It's up to you. But this is what I have seen. So it's almost like a present from the Buddha. Yeah, I have discovered something very profound, very beautiful. It leads to the highest happiness, the elimination of all suffering. That is what I have seen. If you want to go in the same direction, if you want to discover the same thing, this is the right view that accords with that. So the Buddha is just coming from compassion, right? And so then it's up to us to kind of accept that or not. But if you have faith in that, then it makes sense, at least temporarily, to accept those views as potentially right. Yes, this is how these things work. They are accordance with reality. Right intention and all these other factors then are also intentions that somehow or other accord with reality. It's not quite the same with intention, but these other factors, right means whatever leads to positive outcomes, the highest positive outcome being awakening itself. So they are right in the sense that they lead you away from suffering and towards happiness. That is what right means here. We were discussing the idea of free will, whether there is such a thing as free will according to the Buddhist teachings. And this fellow, he said that, well, you know, there has to be free will because otherwise how can there be right effort or right endeavor if you haven't got free will? That sort of requires free will because you are choosing to do the right thing. And the answer is not really. Right effort doesn't necessarily mean it's free will. Right effort is the effort that leads you towards awakening. Wrong effort is the effort that does not lead you to awakening or leads you away from awakening. That's all. It doesn't have any implications for free will or whatever. So all of these ones here, samma is, in the end, it's about what leads to towards awakening, and miccha, wrong factor is what leads away from awakening here. And this is very instructive, and later on we will talk about the factors in more detail, but as an example, people often ask, what is Miccha Samadhi? Yeah, the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is called Samma Samadhi, right stillness. That has a counterpart in Miccha Samadhi, wrong stillness. What do you mean wrong stillness? It sounds like an oxymoron, wrong stillness. That sounds like restlessness, right? Well, how can something be wrong stillness? And the answer is that it doesn't lead to awakening. In other words, it is the stillness that is joined with wrong view. Because if you have stillness, but you also have wrong view going with it, it's not going to lead you to awakening. That kind of gives you the answer to that weird idea of wrong stillness. But wrong stillness is actually mentioned in the suttas, Miccha Samadhi. And that is probably what it means. It doesn't mean just being restless, because that is a kind of... It's too obvious in a sense. So that is just the idea of Samma and Miccha. So please don't feel something bad has happened just because the Buddha says Samma. Samma has actually a very positive connotation. Okay, so now what I'm going to look at is the factors from a different point of view, from the point of view of how they interact with each other. And one of the things about the Noble Eightfold Path is that it is a causal sequence. And so many things in Buddhism are causal sequences. We looked at dependent origination before. That is obviously a causal sequence. But so are many of the path factors, whether it is the Eightfold Path, Seven Factors of Awakening. All of these things are structured, have a certain structure where one thing leads to the next one. This is the thing about the Buddhist teaching. Everything is causal in one way or another. It has to be, because the only alternative is that things have an independent existence. But independent existence means a self, and the Buddha denies that. Yeah? So everything is causal in a sense, and so is the path. This is a very important point about the path. It means that the factors don't work in random. You cannot just choose a random factor, yeah, and they kind of go on a retreat and say, yeah, okay, I'm going to get jhanas, bang, yeah, I'm going to have the jhanas. A lot of people say that, yeah, I'm going to the retreat to get jhanas, but it depends, yeah, how you're practicing the other factors first, because the other factors come first. You can't just decide to get jhana. Number of years ago, we had one of the monks. He told me that when he came to Vrindavan Monastery, he said, "I'm here to get jhana within 5 years." Did he have jhanas within 5 years? No, he had nowhere near jhanas after 5 years, so he disappeared. Well, he went somewhere else to search for jhanas in another monastery. The point is that you can't really, these things don't happen according to your wishes, they happen according to a causal sequence. So if it isn't happening, instead of kind of banging your head against the brick wall, you have to look at this sequence to see what happens, to start at a higher place. So this is how it works, yeah? Each one leading to the next one, starting with the right view. From right view comes right intention comes right speech, then right action, and each one all the way down to right stillness. So that is this is the main sequence of causality of the Noble Eightfold Path. That is not the end of it, though, because there's also feedback, yeah? So, for example, when your mindfulness becomes stronger, it makes your morality better, your right speech better, because you're more able to pick up when you go wrong. So there's a forward movement is the main movement, but there's a subsidiary kind of causal action where the later factors also help the previous ones. That's what I mean. It gets quite complicated. So there's kind of interaction on many different levels here. But the most important sequence is the forward movement from right view all the way to right stillness. So if you're not getting jhanas on your retreat yet, you have to look back earlier on the these factors to ask yourself where you can still improve. Yeah, this is how it works. So let's have a look at this in a bit more detail. Right view leading to right intention. Why does right view lead to right intention? And the answer is that right view, again, is about seeing things in accordance with reality. Yeah, seeing the world as it actually is, That is really what right view is about. When Mudita mentioned the Four Noble Truths, karma and rebirth, and the three characteristics and all of that is part of this idea of right view. So, of course, the point is that when you see things according to reality, and that becomes your view, our view is what decides our values. Yeah, if you view things in a certain way, your values come out of that. What your values, again, decide your priorities in life, what is important to you. And that then decides your whole life, basically. Yeah, your priorities is what you do, it's how you live, it's what you do. All the other factors, in a sense, on the path come out of that. So once you have right view, that will inform your aim in life, which is exactly what right intention is. Your purpose, how you drive your life, the direction that your life takes, comes from that right view. So if your view is aligned with reality, the way things actually are, then you can intend in a way that accords with reality, which is good. Yeah, if your aim accords with the reality, there's a chance you will get something positive out of it. But if your aim does not accord with reality, you have a serious problem. And I always like the very simple kind of similes for showing this. It's like, you know, you wake up in the morning, you need some breakfast, you need to go down to the corner shop or whatever. Are there any corner shops left? I'm not sure. There's all the kind of supermarkets now, supermarket, whatever it is. And you think the corner shop is to the right, but actually it's on the left-hand side. You got wrong view about the corner shop. This is small wrong view, right? This is not really important. But even the small time wrong view means you won't get breakfast because you're going in the wrong direction. Not getting breakfast is called
hunger.
Dukkha. Oh. Yeah. So the result of wrong view is dukkha. Yeah. You have wrong intention. You go in the right direction, and the result is dukkha, and it's a problem. If you have the right view, you have the right intention, and you will achieve the purpose, you will achieve your aim. So it is absolutely fundamental that you have right view, to see the world in the right way, so that your aim and purpose in life is correct. Otherwise, you can never reach a true goal, because you are deluded about the nature of reality. It's very obvious in a way, right? But it's also very important. That's why, from right view, you get right intention. Right purpose, right aim, right goal, heading in the right direction, away from suffering, towards happiness. So that is the idea of right view. I'm going to talk about this in much more detail later on because, again, time is going always, actually, but not supposed to go into great details anyway, so that's good. So, and then once we have the right intention, then from that intention comes then the morality factors. These are the factors of morality: speech, action, and livelihood. I just put them together because they are kind of other, they belong together. So, right view of the world is to understand that defilements or badness inside, leads to suffering, especially if you act on it. If you act on kindness inside, it leads to happiness. So then you start to intend that way. You intend towards metta, away from anger and ill will, towards karuna, away from all the bad things. Yeah, and because that's how you intend, you act accordingly. Intention is what drives our actions. Then we act accordingly. You get right speech, right action, right livelihood. And you avoid the wrong parts. And then also, one of the aspects of right intention is the nekama sankappa. Yeah, nekama meaning renunciation. Literally means giving up of desire. Ni kama. Kama is like sensory desire. So it's the renunciation. How does that happen? Well, it is the, remember, right view. An important part of right view is that understanding the limits of the sensory world. Yeah, how problematic it is. Yeah, in the sensory world, what happens in the sensory world? In the sensory world, you have COVID. Yeah, you have climate change. You have bad politics. Yeah, stupid politicians doing stupid things. And we're all a bit stupid, so we shouldn't really blame our politicians. But you know, that's just they're just an expression of ourselves in many ways. We have wars. Yeah. This is the sensory realm. So after a while, you get fed up with that sensory realm because you realize it is utterly compromised. And everything we try to hold on to in this life, our loved ones, our possessions, whatever it is, they all have to die anyway. How can we hold on too much to that kind of imperfect sensory world? and then you start to move in a different direction. You move towards a spiritual path instead. That is the idea of renunciation. You renounce one thing so you can move to something that is better. That's kind of the point here. Yeah, and this becomes then, and that then becomes felt not so much in the morality, but in the next part of the path, where that right speech and right action leads to light, right effort. So once you have the basic morality, you want to take the path even further, and to take the path further, you have to then purify your mind. Yeah, and part of that is giving up the desires for all the worldly pleasures. And to give up that desire for worldly pleasures, first of all, you have to see the how compromised that world of the five senses is. Yeah, as I just mentioned before, all those things. And then you move towards an inner world instead. You start to build up inner qualities. Of course, those inner qualities are much more resilient to external things because they are within you. So you have more control over those things. There's more resilience there. So this is what right effort is. It is, first of all, you have the external morality, then you have the inner morality within you, where you give up the defilements of the mind, the ill will, the desires, all these kind of things. And as Venerable Mudita said before, you also start developing the good qualities. Once that inner development reaches a certain point, your mind starts to settle down. You become more peaceful, because desires and ill will and all of that, by definition, they are not peaceful. It's very hard to meditate if you have lots of desire and ill will, because these things are, by their very nature, restless, and agitated. So if you're going to have success in a meditation, you can't be too restless and agitated. So the right effort, you're reducing the restlessness and agitation, enables meditation to happen. Meditation is what happens in right mindfulness. Watching the breath is right mindfulness. Yeah, you can see that there's very clear logic here in the path. Yeah, how one thing leads to the next one. And that is why you have this kind of this sequence here. And then as that meditation deepens, as you have keep the awareness on the breath, and as the meditation deepens, then sometimes you stop, you come to a plateau, it doesn't go any deeper. So you ask yourself, why? And the answer very often is that you are attaching to something. You're holding on to that world. You're holding on to your body. You're holding on to the senses. I don't want to let go of my senses. Yeah. So there's some degree of attachment there is the most common reason why you don't go deeper in your meditation. And eventually you learn to let go of that. You learn that the meditation is a greater happiness by trial and error. You let go of the world, which is so unreliable. And eventually one day you get to right stillness, jhana. And that is the end of the path, coming to right stillness, which is very fascinating in itself. So this is the sequential sequence of eight factors. Now what is very interesting here about these eight factors, I want to point this out before we go on, is that it starts with right view. Yeah, so the whole sequence starts with right view, and that means that right view is absolutely fundamental for this whole sequence to actually come into existence. It also means that if you want to strengthen the Noble Eightfold Path, strengthening right view, making right view more clear, is actually one of the things that will enable that Noble Eightfold Path to come into existence more powerfully. How do we get the right view more powerful? How do we strengthen that? Well, one of the main ways is to understand the teachings of the Buddha. Yeah, reading the suttas, whatever it is. Reminding ourselves of the reality that the Buddha taught. And as you do that, right view gets strengthened, and then the whole path kind of works out as a consequence. And I think this is one of the most neglected aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path. This not putting enough attention on right view. So we remember what is important. Why is morality so important? Why does it matter so much? This is kind of right part of right view. Yeah, why it is so important to live with kindness, etc. Why should I live a more spiritual existence rather than being so interested in the worldly pleasures? Why is that? And the more you understand that, this is part of right view, the more you will lean in the right direction. So right view is absolutely fundamental to make this whole thing work out. And it's not just about believing in karma and rebirth. That's part of it. That's only sometimes too technical, perhaps, and too kind of difficult to relate to. So we need to kind of think about this in such a way we can relate to this idea of right view in a way which means something to us. And then it starts to work out. So right view is very important. And then from that right view, you get this cascade all the way down to right stillness, where we are now. And the path ends with right stillness, which is kind of fascinating. Samadhi. Because what about wisdom? What happened to all the understanding? And the answer to that is that that understanding is the outcome of stillness. So this is the path, this is what we need to do, and the outcome of that path is the wisdom and the understanding. It's not part of the path because it is the outcome. It's kind of amazing, isn't it, when you think about it? Because it looks like almost like something is missing there, but that's how the path works. You want to add anything, Venerable?
No. I think enough been said. No. What's 139?
You want to subtract something? Yeah. You can subtract. You don't have to add.
No, I think it has to be all there.
No subtraction? No adding? Yeah.
Not yet.
Should we do some meditation?
Yeah.
So let's carry on now. So let's do some more questions. Maybe the lady who wanted to ask, the lady in pink there, would you still like to ask the question from before? Yeah? Just to, I promised to get back to you, so now is your opportunity here. Yeah.
My question has changed now.
Has it?
So right mindfulness, which you interpret as right meditation. So certainly we do breath meditation, being mindful of the breath. I just want to know how it translates to everyday mindfulness when you're not seated in meditation.
What? Others, she's asking you.
Ah, she's just asking anyone. Oh, yeah. Either one of us, I think. Yeah. Okay. I'll reply first, and he can kind of correct me or criticize me afterwards.
If you're wrong.
If I get it wrong. It will add, or I'll do whatever you want to do. But mindfulness, right mindfulness on the Buddhist path actually means meditation. Yeah, in terms of the seven factors, it means meditation. But mindfulness is also part of right effort, for example. It's a lesser kind of mindfulness. It's not called right mindfulness yet, but to be able to do right effort, to be able to practice the precepts or anything, you need a degree of mindfulness to remind you of what you're supposed to be doing and to be aware of what you're doing. So mindfulness is actually required all the way along, but only when you come to right mindfulness is it strong enough and powerful enough to make meditation possible. That is the difference. So mindfulness is kind of becoming more and more powerful and stronger as you practice the path.
Thank you.
Okay, you are very welcome.
Yeah, it is confusing, I must say. That's why we have the prefix, the samma there, that quite often we quite loosely talk about this mindfulness. But it's at the end it actually does mean that meditation. But it's I was thinking about myself, and it is that the guardian factor is sort of like puts you on every one of those there, like you have wrong speech or whatever, like Ajahn Parmali was saying, that it guards you on that. That's and great. Sets you with the right mindfulness. It's the gatekeeper there, maybe, on everyday life. Metaji. I don't know. I don't think the question was because you didn't have the microphone. That was there an aha moment for the Eightfold Path or before we were monks. But the problem with this, the Eightfold Path is quite a intense teaching. It's sort of like ongoing practice more. And for me, it was more like those basic teachings of that anicca dukkha anatta, like I was saying, and I like to teach those because they're sort of the penny drop moments for me, was that I realized that these are actually truths. So this is actually how the world works. But in the same way, I encourage for everybody to look at this, the Eightfold Path as well, that it actually has to work in real life. Ajahn Parmali's been saying here that what's missing, why isn't your meditation working? It's something is missing from the previous path factors, and you keep moving along, and it's a nice feedback loop there. So, but I don't remember. Do you have it yourself? Did you have something because you asked that question? Or? What did you want the right view to be?
Relationships, you could walk up into the sunset.
Okay.
You know, you could have a good job. And I think the nice thing, two things I shared with my group. One was Bhikkhu Bodhi suggesting that the eight factors were like strands that wrapped around each other, and the eight factors could be in the one moment of consciousness. And then the second is, as you understood it more, it led to an urgency, like your head was on fire, to find out more and to delve into the ones that... I think when a couple of serious things went wrong in lay life, I kind of went looking, and I was lucky to find that.
Right.
I think I always... I mean, some of the factors of the Eightfold Path were always kind of fairly obvious about morality. You know, I always believed in, you know, being living reasonably well. I was never a complete scallywag. I was pretty bad, but not that bad. But I think for me, it was more just a general idea as a Buddhist. That kind of made sense. The path itself was not the most important thing here, but just the general ideas of, you know, of... I suppose the idea of giving up craving and this general, you know, sense of the distinction between happiness and suffering, that here's someone who actually laid down a very clear difference between happiness and suffering in the world. And I knew that I wanted to be content, happy. I knew I didn't want any more problems. I had enough as I had it, yeah? And so there was a general idea of Buddhism which makes very good sense to me. And the path kind of gradually can become more clear. It's both at this... instantaneous, but also very gradual development of these things, I think. But I think, I don't know, I, you know, always people ask me why I'm a Buddhist monk, and I think because I was a Buddhist monk in the past life. Yeah, that's why I was a Buddhist monk. Yeah. So I didn't choose this myself, I just kind of carrying on. It's a good habit, it's just a habit, yeah? It's a good one, but it's a habit nonetheless. That's what I reckon. Okay, so Okay.
Thank you. I'll just stand here. It's faster. I was just wondering if I could clarify your explanation or translation of the first sub-factor of right intention. You mentioned nekama being sort of out and kama being the sensory world. So it is sensory world and not just sensory pleasure. It is bigger than that. It's going out of the sensory world itself. Is that correct? And also, you know how Ajahn Brahm sort of popularizes it or makes it a more friendly translation to just his repeated, you know, making peace, being kind, being gentle instruction. I've always wondered about the making peace part, because that sounds a bit different from this idea of going out of the sensory world. Is it, actually in the language of the suttas, it's mainly used as going out of the sensory world, or is it more broadly renouncing all sorts of things? I mean, using this idea of making peace is sort of could apply to very broadly. So I was just wondering if you could clarify that.
Well, the word nekama is quite literally the opposite of karma, which is the sensory world. So it is quite literally leaving the sensory world behind. That's quite literally what it's about. It really refers to that. But that is where non-peace happens in that world. That's the world of desire. That's the world of restlessness. The world of agitation really is in that world. And there isn't that much apart from that world. There's a little bit, of course, in the sense of self and that. But the main restlessness and problems is in that world. Once you leave that world behind, you know, samadhi is yours, basically, for the taking. That's largely gone. So I don't know if Ajahn Brahm just went by his experience, or whether he actually thought about this carefully. If I know him right, he just went by his experience. That's the way he usually works. But I think it's pretty spot on. It's pretty much what it is. So I think it works personally. Yeah.
The use of his making peace, he sometimes uses it to make peace with your, you know, restless mental states or your whatever, your anger, the more sort of, I guess, mental experiences and not just the sensory world. So I'm wondering whether...
Is that right? It all comes from the sensory world, ultimately. That's where the problem, that's where it arises from. So I think it is ultimately the same thing.
Have restlessness about your confusion about Dhamma concepts, right? I mean,
Dhamma restlessness. Like,
you could have, you know,
You could. It's true. Maybe there is. But I think 95% is probably the sensory world. I'll just very briefly take a question from outside of the center here. Where have you gone? Let's see if I can get it back again. Where would it be?
Here? Coming. Double click. Is it in the notes or? It's about the Four Noble Truths.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so just very briefly, because this might be taking us a little bit too far afield, but this is from Gabriel. Hi, Gabriel. Gabriel comes here quite regularly. I know Gabriel quite well. And he asks, I would like to ask Venerable Brahmali, okay, you can't answer this one, to talk about the specific tasks associated with each of the Four Noble Truths and how Samaditti relate to them. Thank you. So this is a reference to the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. These four tasks are mentioned in that sutta. And what it says is that the Four Noble Truths, right? The first one is the truth of suffering. So the task for that one is to understand it fully. That's the task. Yeah. Second Noble Truth is the cause of suffering. And the task there is to abandon the cause, yeah, so that we don't have suffering. That's a task related to that one. Third one is third noble truth of the cessation, yeah, of Nibbana, if you like. The task there is to realize it, yeah, through meditation. And the last one is the noble truth of the path leading to cessation. And the task there is to develop the path, yeah. These are the four tasks. Understanding, abandoning, realization, and development. And if you want to read more about that, go to the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta found in the Sanghita Nikaya, 56 Sanghita, on the Four Noble Truths, Sutta number 11. That's where it is found. It's one of the most famous suttas in the entire Tipitaka. How is Samaditti relate to these four truths, or these four tasks? Especially very important when it comes to the first noble truth, Samaditti, yeah, the understanding of the sensory realm. So you understand the idea of dukkha. How do we understand dukkha? Well, the Samaditti is precisely about that. Yeah, Samaditti is understanding the Four Noble Truths. One of the most fundamental, one of those is to understand suffering itself, understanding the nature of suffering here. Yeah, I was just talking before about the sensory realm. Usually, one of the biggest hindrances for anyone who's practicing this path is holding on to the sensory realm. We attach to all kinds of things within that realm, because that is pretty much the only realm we know about. Yeah, everything we do from the moment we wake up till we go to bed is involved in that sensory realm. It's very hard not to be utterly involved in that realm. And so we need to gradually see the problems with that realm, how unsatisfactory it is, how out of control it is, yeah, etc., etc. And as we do that, we gradually move out of that. That is the understanding of that. It is the right view. Seeing it from the way the Buddha explains it, then trying to see it in the same way in our own life, that these things actually are true from our own experience as well. Yeah, and this is understanding of dukkha, seeing the sensory realm like that, etc., etc. And of course, so that I think is one of the main relationships between Samaditti and these truths. Yeah, and of course, there is also a degree of faith involved in all of this, because the faith, for example, the third noble truth is about the cessation of things. It's very hard to kind of know that directly. So you have to have a degree of confidence and faith that this is actually possible to make an end of all of this. But you can have some degree, again, this is a samaditti that, or right view that arises in meditation practice. You start to see things fading away, moving towards cessation, moving towards nibbana. You get little bits of nibbana in your meditation, yeah, a little bit fading away. Tiny, small nibbana and big nibbana. So you start with a small nibbana, things fading away. Wow, this is really good. And then you kind of get right view just by becoming peaceful. People think that nibbana sounds really scary because things ending or ceasing. But again, the way to see that is just to check out in your own meditation. And in your meditation, you will see that ending of things actually is very, very nice. Okay, I'm not going to say more about that because time is going very fast. The next question, very briefly. When greed arises in the mind, the person can be aware of greed that arose with sati. But what can you actively do to ensure, to learn from it and ensure such greed does not arise? Well, what you can do is you have to have the right view again. Yeah, remind yourself of the negative aspects of the thing that you have greed for. And gradually your greed for those things will disappear as you do that. Also, what you can do is just develop the path. And as you develop the path, greed naturally starts to decline as well. Okay, let's stop there because... okay, so let's carry on. So far we have looked at the how the noble four, the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path condition each other, starting from right view, ending with right stillness, one after the other. Yeah, this is the main kind of sequence of conditioning. And it is the main one because without right view, nothing happens. Yeah, right view is absolutely essential, at least a little bit of right view. Yeah, you have. Remember, right view is not like either you have it or you don't. There's degrees of it. Yeah, you have a little bit. But if you have nada, no right view whatsoever, you're not going to do anything. Yeah, you're going to have wrong intention. You're not going to be kind to anyone. You're going to be a nasty piece of works and all of that kind of stuff as a consequence. So a little bit of right view is required. And then it comes in all kind of degrees. So we want to strengthen it as much as possible. So that is the main sequence forward. But again, the reality is that there's also a feedback system. The later factors on the path feed back to the earlier ones. So it's quite a complicated conditioning system. All the factors are really intertwined with each other in a certain way. Yeah. So let's see how this works. This is from Majjhimanikaya 117, the Great 40 Sutta. And... it says this, right view comes first. How? When you understand wrong speech as wrong speech and right speech as right speech, that is your right view. Yeah, so you have to understand, you have to have some appreciation of what wrong speech is to be able to practice in the right way. Yeah, so if you think shouting at others is okay, then you have wrong view according to Buddhism. But if you think shouting at others is not a good idea, then you have right view about speech. If you think lying is good because it gets me what I want, that's wrong view. But if you think lying actually shouldn't do it, even if it gets me what I want, because in the long run it will be detrimental, then you have right view. Yeah. So right view, obviously, as we've seen all along here, is the foundation for all of the other factors. Yeah. Right view works with each factor to inform it and to make sure that you practice it in the right way. So that's your right view in regard to right speech. And this is can be quite subtle. Yeah, I mean, one thing is to understand that outright lying is bad, but it can be very subtle what is right speech. You know, one of the things that we probably do too much of is probably talk too much, generally speaking. And the more right view you have, the more quiet you become as a person. And it's interesting, I can see someone like, Ajahn Brahm, maybe you think he's very talkative because he sits up here and he tells lots of jokes and kind of carries on with stories and all kind of things. He sounds maybe like a very jolly, talkative person. But if you know Ajahn Brahm, he doesn't talk all that much. In the monastery, sometimes we have kind of a tea time in the evening and sometimes the monks come out. And often Ajahn Brahm just sits there, and the other monks kind of carry on saying silly things. But Ajahn Brahm doesn't say so many silly things, yeah? Well, when he speaks, it's silly, but it doesn't really... It has the purpose to make you relax and make you feel happy and at ease. He doesn't talk just for the sake of talking, yeah? Usually his speech has a very particular purpose. And it's quite interesting to see that. See the same with the Buddha in the suttas, even more so. And with most people who are wise, you notice that. Anyway. So, you make an effort to give up wrong speech and embrace right speech. That's your right effort. So the more developed your effort is, the more you understand right effort, the more right effort is informed by right view. Yeah, so that you, if the more strongly your right view is, the more you use that effort moment to moment. So you're always aware of what is going on, always adjusting your speech if you have to. Yeah, so right effort is kind of fundamental here to make right speech work. So it goes backwards, yeah, because right effort is factor number 6, whereas right speech is factor number 3. It kind of goes from the later factor back to the earlier one. It's a feedback from the later factors. The better that right effort is, the more ability you have to speak in the right way. Mindfully, you give up right speech and take up right speech. That is your right mindfulness. The more mindfulness you have, the better speech you're going to have, because you are aware of what is happening in your mind. This is one of the hardest things, yeah? In daily life, you lose your awareness of what you're saying. Suddenly stuff comes out of your mouth. You think, what am I saying? And it's too late. You can't take it back again. Yeah, the words that have come out of your mouth, it's kind of too late then. So mindfulness enables you to regulate the way you live. It's one of the very important aspects of mindfulness. And that is why mindfulness is called the adipatthaya. Adipatthaya means something like you become in charge of yourself. You become the self, you become a ruler, you become a sovereign. You are in charge of your life. Without mindfulness, you're not in charge of your life. If your mindfulness is strong, you have a feeling of being in charge, because you can choose how you think, what you say, how you act. A lot of the time we can't even choose. It just comes out automatically. Yeah. Before we know it, we've done the wrong thing. But mindfulness allows you to be feeling that you are in charge when mindfulness becomes very strong. That's why it has this called the adipatthaya. You are in charge of yourself. So these three things keep running and circling around right speech, namely right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. So it is complex, yeah? And then you come to right stillness, and when you come out of really deep meditation, your entire way of relating to the world is completely different, yeah? The defilements of the mind, the ill will, desires in the sensory world are completely eliminated, and you are completely at peace, often for long, long periods of time after these deep states of mind. You don't really want to talk very much. You want to be quiet. You want to be by yourself. And so all of these things revolve around each other. But, and this is the main point of the sequence, the most important conditionality here is the one that starts with the right view and goes through the 8 factors. It is the most important, because without the first factors, the later ones will never happen at all. That is where we have to look out the most to strengthen the path. This is you.
Are we going to move on?
It's 2:00. Oh, it's 2:00? Yeah. Let's just carry on until... Shall we carry on? Because it's 2:00. I don't think... Or do you want to have a short break? Let's have a 5-minute meditation without Q&A. How's that?
Okay. Everybody's sleeping, so I'm just thinking.
Yeah. Time to... Okay. Okay, let's carry on.
Very good. Oh, we can see people are getting tired, so but don't feel bad about it if you fall asleep. Hey, we don't care. Don't snore too loud, but it's okay. It's this time of the day is always difficult, especially because you eat and then you come here. Afternoons are always difficult. Well, we are awake because we're teaching. Okay.
That's the one.
Yeah, I know, but I wanted to sit. It doesn't show because I think we put it too dark, but I'm teaching the root causes of the path. That should be the header there, which is above it, but that's too dark.
Sorry.
Okay. Huh? Yes, fading off in the past. But so, what are the root causes for the path? What are the what keeps you going? How do you get this path started? So I took similes from the suttas. Sir, who says that? I forget now.
Ananda.
Ananda, maybe yes. Yeah. Sir, good friends, companions, and associates are half of the spiritual life. Ananda telling to Buddha. I remember now. Not so, Ananda. Good friends, companions, and associates are the whole of the spiritual life. So, so in this sutta, hang on, does it continue? Oh yeah. Okay, a mendicant with good friends, companions, and associate can expect to develop and cultivate the noble eightfold path. This is in Sanyutta Nikaya. Quite a famous. Sutta, where the Ananda says that, you know, it's important to have good friends, that it's half of the spiritual life. And the Buddha said, no, Ananda, it's the whole thing. It's the whole path is actually one of the main root causes. Why do we practice as Ajahn Pamali and I? Why do you practice? You heard the Dhamma from somewhere, from us maybe now today. And we heard it from somewhere else before. The Buddha heard it somewhere else himself. So that you lend your ear, you give your ear, you listen to the teachings, we read them. We don't have the Buddha anymore these days, but so we have other good companions. Kalyanamitta is the word we have in Pali. So that's one of the good one of the root causes of first one. Anything you want to say?
Press the bar space.
Oh, sorry. And, okay, there's another sutta from this. And then in this one, the Buddha is speaking to the king, which I don't remember which king.
Pasenadi,
okay. And here's another way to understand how good friends are the whole of the spiritual life. 4, by relying on me, the Buddha, as a good friend, sentient beings who are liable to rebirth, old age, and death, the sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress, are freed from all these things. So if you rely on the Buddha as the first Kalyanamitta, and you give ear to the Buddha, Buddha's teaching, you will end this path. So this is one of the beginnings of the path. What gets you going is to listen to the Buddha. Okay, so I put a little example here of good friends, and I put monk friends there on the top left. Then we have the Buddha, obviously, and somebody we know there on the bottom left. And then I put a picture there of here, picture from outside. So all of these things, and I think I can see Eddie there on the underneath the Buddha there in the crowds. Where's Eddie, by the way?
Where's Eddie? Exactly. He's missing. Eddie, where are you?
Everybody knows Eddie. he's somewhere there. These are all the good friends. We all are Kalyanamitas to others. And you have other Kalyanamitas. Remember, that's an important thing. And that's why you need to go and see somebody who inspires you. You need to read the suttas which inspire you from the Buddha. You associate yourself with good friends, and that keeps the path going. That's how you're on the bus. That's why I like it, because, as I said earlier, I might not be the brain scientist or the rocket scientist, but I have enough wisdom to put myself into a situation where I associate myself I associate with somebody like Ajahn Pomali. I follow him like the shadow.
Right.
Or Ajahn Brahm. And other monks and nuns. And people from here. I hear people tell me something, oh, that's smart. I didn't think of that way. So you are my Kalyanamitas, and we are yours. So there's a beautiful feedback loop there. And one of the things why we are mendicants, like Pandit Suchato translated, it's because we rely on you, and you rely, and then on that you feed us, we feed you the Dhamma, and there is the feedback loop in Theravada Buddhism. That's why we, as a monks, nuns, we cannot just live by ourselves in the forest. We need to keep teaching. We are Kalyanamitas to each other. And another root cause to the path. So there's two. Mendicants, the dawn is the forerunner and precursor of the sunrise. In the same way, accomplishment in proper attention is the forerunner and precursor of the Noble Eightfold Path for a mendicant. This doesn't probably continue. No, because I have the sutta. Proper attention, yoniso manasikara, or wise attention, as it is sometimes translated. I actually a bit lost myself, so maybe Ajahn Pomali can give a brief description of the yoniso manasikara.
It just means that when you think about things in the way the Buddha saw them, that's basically what it means, then you will tend to live in the right way. But if you think about things contrary to how the Buddha saw them, in other words, contrary to reality, you will tend to do the wrong thing. Right view is it's very closely related to right view, that they are yonis or manasikara. So you attend to things means that, you know, you look at someone, and if you look at someone, Ananda, for example, I can look at Ananda as a friend, then I feel happy. Or if I upset Ananda, you will maybe, I don't know if you ever get angry with me, but maybe you get a little bit irritated because I say something that is really kind of out of bounds or something like that. That irritation where I get irritated with you, maybe I can't remember ever having gotten irritated by you, but maybe potentially it might happen, then that is your ayoniso manasikara, wrong attention, because you are looking at someone contrary to the Dhamma. So it's defined in the Majjhima Nikaya 2, it's defined wise attention is attention which leads to wholesome qualities. Unwise attention is attention that gives rise to unwholesome qualities. So whenever you attend to something, you look at something, bad qualities arise, bad attention, otherwise good attention. Mm.
So that's right. So proper attention or wise attention is the ways of translating it. So these are the two root causes. So I have another simile here. Proper attention is the mental factor responsible for turning the mind to the object. How do you attend to anything? Oh, this is okay. I remember now. This is from the Bhikkhu Bodhi. So the attention, the manasikara, is like the rudder of the ship which directs it to the destination. Or like the charioteer who sends the well-trained horses, meaning the states, like the loving kindness, towards the destination, the object. So you have to have the proper attention. Quality of the attention here and now, so that causes good qualities to increase and bad ones to decline. Okay, so this is from the Majjhima Nikaya 2. So those are the two root causes. Wise attention and good friends. And it continues. I forgot. And how does a mendicant with a good friends develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path? It is when the mendicant develops right view.
Okay.
This is yours, is it?
Of course.
Yeah. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. So that's very, very, very briefly, because we're talking about things that lead to the cultivation of the Noble Eightfold Path. And so these are other factors that lead to that cultivation. This is a little bit more deep. So these are factors that were mentioned by Venerable Karunika just before. And these are factors that are often found in association with the factors of awakening, the bhujangas, usually these are found, but they're also found occasionally with the Noble Eightfold Path. And so these are the things that help you develop the Noble Eightfold Path, right? The supporting factors, if you like. So you rely on seclusion, yeah? This is why if you want to meditate, you might come and stay at Bodhinana Monastery, you might go to Jhana Grove Retreat Center, hang out there, not just hanging out, but actually sitting down as well, hanging out and sitting down there. Yeah, and so you have physical seclusion leading to mental seclusion, kaya viveka leading to chitta viveka. So seclusion is something you see throughout the suttas that are necessary for the deeper aspects of the path to work. You don't need to be secluded to be kind, of course, but for the deeper aspects, especially the awakening factors, and here the deeper parts of the Noble Eightfold Path, it is a requirement. Fading away, viraga, this is the idea of things fading away. When you meditate, yeah, you kind of become more and more peaceful, things kind of disappearing from your consciousness, thinking less, perceiving less, less and less things happening in your mind, gradually fading away, the senses fading away, and then disappearing, cessation. Yeah, the more things cease, the more developed the Noble Eightfold Path is. The Noble Eightfold Path depends on these qualities to develop fully. And when things cease, really starts to cease, and you start to get insight based on that cessation, it ripens in letting go, pati-ni-sagga, yeah, which means letting go, relinquishing all of those things, because you see them as dukkha, as suffering, as problematic. So it ripens in relinquishment. This is like the deep insights of the Third Noble Truth, yeah, nibbana and all of that, part of pati-ni-sagga. So this is kind of a beautiful expression, I think, of meditation practice. And this particular sequence of things, you see it also in the Anapanasati Sutta, mindfulness of breathing. The last four of 16 stages of Anapanasati are all about what happens in the mind, part of the insight process, if you like, which is exactly the same factors as you see. No, not exactly, because there you have anicca instead of viveka, but the other ones are the same. So very similar. So the unity of the path is very beautiful. Anyway, So I'm not going to say anything more about that. So go.
What's the?
Okay, results of the path. Okay, let's look at some of the root causes. What makes the Noble Eightfold Path happen? You have to have Kalyanamittas, the Buddha being the number one Kalyanamitta. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm is a pretty awesome Kalyanamitta. Yeah, and all of us here today, we're all kind of Kalyanamittas. We're kind of helping each other in the right direction. So that is all the causes of the path, including Yono Samanasikara. But now, so that is the before right view. What makes right view happen? You have to have the Buddha in the background, the Kalyanamitta in the background, for right view even to exist. So that is one end of the Eightfold Path. But at the other end, after Samma Samadhi, what happens there? Because the path ends with Samma Samadhi, with right stillness. So these are the results of the path, what the expected outcomes are. And so this is the Noble Eightfold Path in brief, right view going to right stillness. And the results of that is right knowledge and right liberation. And this is the tenfold, sometimes called the tenfold path. Yeah, these are kind of the two factors added, but it's not really the path anymore because these are the outcomes of the path. So when you have right stillness, you will know things according to reality by default or by naturally because of that samadhi you have. So that is the outcome, yeah? Knowing things according to reality. So what does that do? Well, it actually feeds back into right view at the beginning. And so at that point, you become a stream mentor. Right view becomes kind of permanent. Yeah, you see things as they really are. Bang, once and for all, you are a stream mentor. And then the path gets internalized. And now you carry the path with you wherever you go. You don't really need any more teachings once you are a stream mentor because you know how the path works, the knowledge. Then you keep on practicing that knowledge. You still keep on practicing the path because you're a stream mentor, and eventually it ripens in liberation. Liberation from what? From suffering, right? No more suffering. You have attained the highest happiness. That is what the liberation is from. This is the result of the path. Sound all right? For those of you who are still awake, yeah? Sound. So, sounds pretty good, right? Liberation from suffering. So, okay. So, this was very briefly. So, this is...
For me. So, I have these kitten pictures and pictures of trees and stuff. So, sorry about that. I'm not so technical.
You're so cute.
Yes.
That's why.
Well, you know. Okay, so another simile of the Buddha's awakening, because this is the what comes after the path factors have been concluded. So the 10th factor has been fulfilled. So Buddha's awakening. What happened to the Buddha when he discovered the path? So I recall sitting in the cool shade of the rose apple tree while my father, the Sakyan, was off working. What was he doing? He was actually blowing the fields. He was doing they say ceremonial blowing. I don't know what that means really. But so that's, I found a picture of rose apple tree. Even Ajahn Pamali didn't know what it looks like. So, hey, there we go. But you can see a little boy sitting underneath that rose apple tree. Nice, isn't it? Yeah, okay. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unskillful qualities, I entered and remained in the first absorption, jhana, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion while placing the mind and keeping it connected. So I like that one. It's quite secluded from sensual pleasures, so you don't have to be a perfect person.
Here quite means fully.
Fully. Oh, yeah, sorry.
That's what quite means in this case.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And the Buddha thought, this is actually, by the way, I'll give the little bit of background story. That this is actually after the Buddha's been striving and, you know, hurting himself. He was on the one end of that of the spiritual path where we talked about earlier. So he was actually tormenting himself. He thought the body was on the way. But then he thought, maybe this is the path to awakening. Stemming from that memory came the realization.
Ding, ding, ding. Da, da, ding, da, da. Ding. What realization came? That's the question.
Bam. This is the path to awakening. Seva maggo bodhayati. So that's the awakening. So bodhaya. So the Buddha comes from there. So it's interesting that the Buddha, it's always said that the Buddha, he discovered the path. He was the first one to discover it. But then how come he, as a little boy, went into deep meditation, and then as a 30, how old was he when he became awakened?
35.
Yeah. So he was struggling and striving for years and years, and then he all of a sudden he realized, hang on, I had this experience when I was a little boy, that I was really in a deep state that is the path. And then he sat down and he resolved to strive that way, and he realized that that is the way. So that it's the happiness of the mind what leads you to the end of the path. And I guess it's me continuing. No, it's your. Oh no, sorry. This was the
Q&A. Oh, that one. Okay.
It went there. Okay.
Next one.
That's now it's you.
That's not.
No, sorry.
Okay. So I hope you are not too sleepy, because now I'm really going to bamboozle you completely. So I hope you're ready to be bamboozled. And not only discombobulated, but also bamboozled. So we have using all this. one of the questions that was asked before was, what is the connection between the Noble Eightfold Path and dependent origination? How do you kind of merge these things? And it's a kind of favorite question of people. They ask, well, what is the connection between the five aggregates and dependent origination? Yeah, people want to understand how these things fit together. Because I often say that all the Dhamma is like one big picture. Yeah, and each of these teachings is like a puzzle, part of the puzzle, one piece in this big picture puzzle. So people, because I say that, and especially my own fault if I'm saying that, then people ask me, how do these things fit together? Yeah, how do this jigsaw kind of fit together? That's what people ask. So I have to take responsibility for my own asking for these questions, really. So how do these things fit together? And first thing, just to very quickly remind you of dependent origination, I just call it DO here. Remember, it starts out with avidya, ignorance at the very top, ignorance or delusion, whatever, however you want to translate that word. From that delusion, you start willing things. You do all kind of activities and actions, willed actions, yeah, through ignorance. And eventually, all of that willed actions then leads to rebirth down the track. And then because you are born, you're going to get old, you're going to die, and you're going to suffer as a consequence. That is dependent origination, super duper briefly. Doesn't get much briefer than that. And so the Noble Eightfold Path, we have just seen that the Noble Eightfold Path is about the opposite. It's about knowledge. Yeah, we just looked at the outcome of the Noble Eightfold Path just before. The outcome is to know and then be liberated. And of course, knowledge is the opposite of ignorance. Yeah, so we have the dependent origination, and then we have the factors, the Noble Eightfold Path factors, yeah? Right view to right stillness, which leads to knowledge, yeah? And of course, or right understanding, if you like. And of course, that right understanding, that must destroy ignorance. Hey, work. Okay. Okay, thank you. Oops. Okay. So ignorance must fade because you have right understanding. It's the opposite of... And because ignorance fades, the next factors must fade. Because remember, dependent origination is also one factor leading to the next one. So if ignorance ceases, willed actions and everyone all the way down the track must cease. Birth must cease. Eventually, old age and death and suffering must cease. So this is the first way in which dependent origination and the Noble Eightfold Path work together. The Noble Eightfold Path overturns the root cause of dependent origination, which is ignorance. Yeah, it's kind of obvious. I'm sure you can kind of all sort of get the idea of what is happening there. But there are other ways of understanding this interrelationship. So again, you have ignorance, yeah? We start off, we don't know what we're doing. Then you have the willed actions that are a consequence of that. These are all the actions that we do based on ignorance, yeah? Now, these willed activities can include the activities of the spiritual path. Yeah, so the willed actions can be equal to the Noble Eightfold Path, because when we act according to the spiritual path, we are also acting. It's also willed actions. I want to say something nice to my super-duper friend, Venerable Mudita. Yeah? It's a willed action, but it's part of the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah? So these are also willed actions, in a sense. And as we practice that Noble Eightfold Path, eventually it leads to right knowledge, as we have seen before. That right knowledge, in turn, boom! Yeah, it destroys ignorance, as we just saw before. And because of that, right knowledge destroying right ignorance means that ignorance ends. Because ignorance ends, the willed activities end, and everything ends and suffering ends. Yeah? So the will, the sankharas, the second factor of dependent origination, they are the willed activities. They are one way of thinking about those willed activities is the Noble Eightfold Path, because that is one way of acting. And then that destroys ignorance at the beginning, and the whole thing ceases. Another way of looking at this is starting with the factor of vedana, or feeling. I'm going a bit fast because time is getting quite short. So starting with vedana, feeling, this is the seventh factor, is that right? Seventh factor, something like that, of dependent origination. From feeling, of course, we have craving, standard sequence of dependent origination, because we feel the world, good and bad feelings, we must crave according to those feelings. That craving in turn leads to grasping. Yeah, we grasp things because we think that through grasping the right things, holding on, taking things up, upadana in Pali, we can control our feelings by grasping things. Now, one of the things that we can grasp is the spiritual life, the Noble Eightfold Path. You come across the teaching of the Buddha and you grasp them. One way of doing that is having all the books in your kuti, holding on to your books. Yeah? Oh, that's what I have in my kuti. Nobody can touch my books. Yeah? Keep your hands away from my books. That's called grasping. Yeah? So that is why grasping is also equal to the Noble Eightfold Path. I always say that people, you know, if you're going to live a moral life, you have to hold on to that morality to some extent. If you don't hold on to your morality at all, it means you're not going to be moral. A little bit of holding on. You have to think, yeah, I'm going to do this. A little bit of determination is required. Otherwise, you're just going to follow your craving blindly. So there is a degree of grasping, and that practice in the Noble Eightfold Path is that aspect of grasping. Yeah, but because you are practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, it ends in knowledge again. Because it ends in right knowledge, craving ends. Because that is right knowledge, is that you are no longer deluded about the nature of reality. You understand that things are suffering in the world. Because things in the world are suffering, you cannot crave for suffering, so craving must end. Yeah? That's how it works. Knowledge means understanding suffering. It means understanding everything's in terms of the three characteristics, suffering, anicca, impermanent suffering, and non-self, like Venerable Mudita was talking about before. When you see that, craving must end. And of course, when craving ends, then grasping ends, rebirth ends, suffering ends. So, I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but hopefully it makes a little bit of sense. Yeah, you can see how these things kind of come together. This was a specific question, so I thought I would reply to that. There's probably many other ways of integrating these things. One of the things I was thinking about, this is showing you how the Noble Eightfold Path fits into dependent origination. But you could also turn it around and show how dependent origination fits into the Noble Eightfold Path. That's another possibility here. But it's not quite as straightforward. So I thought instead of carrying on with this for too long, I'll just stop there. Okay. 2:31. Wow. We have got so much. There's a lot more in there. Shall we stop there? Maybe we should stop there and then do the rest afterwards. Are people exhausted? No, not exhausted. Okay, Thomas is not exhausted.
Thomas just walked in half an hour.
just starting. Just carry on. Okay. I can go on for another 10 minutes or so, or we can stop. What is good? 10 more minutes? 10 minutes? Okay. Wow, you're so... I like this kind of attitude. Okay, good. So what I want to do now we're kind of coming on to a slightly different idea. Now we have looked at... the relationship in the path from many different angles and things. Now what I want to do is to show you how the practice of Buddhism is explained in many different ways in the suttas. It is explained as the three trainings, three sikkhas. It is explained as the gradual training. It is explained in terms of dependent liberation. It is explained in many individual suttas in all kind of various ways. And I want to show you how all of these things actually are equivalent to the Noble Eightfold Path and how these things fit together. And this is quite interesting because it makes you more capable of grasping what is going on when you read these suttas. Yeah. So for this reason, I want to do that. So the first thing I want to show is how the Noble Eightfold Path relates to the three trainings, or the three practices. This is called sikkha in Pali. Yeah. So the three sikkhas are morality, stillness, and wisdom. Yeah. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. This is kind of a standard set in the sutta as you find all the time. This is an alternative way of talking about the path. So how do these three trainings relate to the Noble Eightfold Path? So morality is right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Yeah? Makes sense? Yeah, that's what you would expect. So is the morality here, the morality which is the sikkha, is that exactly the same as the three factors of the Noble Eightfold Path? What is the exact relationship between these two? And in the sutta which talks about this, this is found in Majjhima Nikaya 44, the Chula Vedala Sutta, it says that the three factors of the Noble Eightfold Path are included within morality. Morality is not included in within the other things. So what that means is that morality is probably broader than these three factors. Yeah, I when Mudita was just explaining before the right action, for example, you said there's three kinds of right action: not to kill, not to steal, and not to do any sexual improper conduct. So what about torturing people? Is that okay?
Yep.
It's okay.
Depending how you torture. Is asking difficult questions about Dhamma?
Is that torturing people? So torturing people is okay according to the Noble Eightfold Path, right?
That's it.
That is, yeah, that's pretty cool, isn't it? So, but obviously torturing people is not okay, right? It's obviously bad. And this shows you that the way we normally define these things is not complete. And the same thing, if you look at the morality of a Buddhist monk, a Buddhist nun, the Patimokkha rules, not everything is there. You can still do many dodgy things and be a, you know, you look like the perfect monk on the outside. I keep all the rules, yeah, but still you can do many dodgy things even if you keep all the rules. So don't think that just because you keep all the rules, you're a good monk, yeah? Maybe we are more dodgy than you think. So, but the point here is that ultimately it's not about keeping certain rules. What it is about is coming from kindness. And that's why it is often much more useful to think in terms of kindness than to think in terms of rules, because rules are always kind of, you become a lawyer after a while and you find the little loopholes, yeah, I can torture, okay. There's certain people you don't like, yeah, so you can kind of, I haven't broken any precepts, yeah, but you're still breaking your morality. So the idea here is that morality is larger than these three factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So don't take these factors as final. The final thing is coming from good qualities inside. Then we have right stillness or samadhi, not right, but samadhi, which is the second of these sikkhas, which here is right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. It's kind of interesting that right effort and right mindfulness is part of stillness. And the reason for that is that right mindfulness is called the parikara. It is called like the requisite, no, that's the effort called requisite, nimitta, the cause, I think. I call it the cause, if you like. Right mindfulness is the cause, nimitta, support maybe, support or cause, yeah. So it is the nimitta, the support, or the cause of stillness, right mindfulness. Yeah, so this is actually very interesting. Normally, when we talk about mindfulness or right mindfulness, we think in terms of vipassana or insight. But here, it is classified right with samadhi. It is an aspect of samadhi, right mindfulness. Is that kind of fascinating? Yeah, this is kind of core Dhamma teaching. Right mindfulness is part of right samadhi. Why? Because it leads to samadhi. If you practice right mindfulness meditation in the right way, it leads to samadhi, leads to stillness. And then right effort is called the parikara of samadhi. Parikara means like a requisite, yeah, something or a prerequisite. In other words, something which aids you. And the reason why it aids you is because you need that right effort to overcome the bad qualities of mind, which blocks samadhi from happening. Certain kinds of defilements, etc. So this is also kind of interesting, right? And then we have the last one, wisdom, in the wisdom sikkha, which is equivalent to right view and right intention. And again, this is quite interesting because in the Noble Eightfold Path begins with right view and right intention, but the three trainings end with wisdom. It's almost like it's inverted. One has wisdom at the beginning, the other one has wisdom at the end. So what is it? It's confusing, isn't it? What is it? How can that possibly be right? Someone must have messed up the word of the Buddha. Surely someone has remembered wrong. Yeah? How can in one way say one thing and the other way say the exact opposite? Surely some dodgy monk has misremembered the suttas in the old days, a long, long time ago. Man, that was me in my past life. Oh, bad karma. Or destined for hell maybe in my next destination or whatever. Who knows? But this is interesting because it shows you, you know, I don't think anyone has misremembered. But the point is just that the way we think about these things, there are different ways of looking at this. And every time we resolve apparent contradictions like this, we gain a deeper understanding of the path. So, right view and right intention, even though they are an aspect of wisdom, when they stand at the beginning, they are like the preliminary wisdom. When they stand at the end, it is the profound wisdom arising out of stillness. So, right view and right intention, and this is why one of the reasons why we make a distinction between the ordinary Eightfold Path and the supramundane or the higher Noble Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path of the Aryas, the noble ones, like the stream enterer, yeah, that is the path that begins with, that has the full wisdom at the beginning. Yeah. Yeah? So you gain the full wisdom, you become a stream enterer, that informs, becomes the right view at the beginning, and that is where the right Noble Eightfold Path becomes internalized. So that is the supramundane, but so that is kind of, I think this is kind of, but then there is the kind of the very basic wisdom, the wisdom of ordinary right view and right intention that you get when you start out on the path. Yeah, and that is not really the wisdom that we're talking about here. Here we're talking about the more profound wisdom that leads to stream entry, and then the Noble Eightfold Path becomes solidified as part of the insight into a reality as it actually is. I can feel here that my explanations are getting more and more blurred and more dodgy, so maybe this is a time now to call it a day before we kind of fall into complete chaos. So let's stop there, and we're going to have quite a long break, and we're going to have a meditation from 3 to 3:45. I think Venerable Munisara, are you going to lead the meditation today? Yeah? Okay. So Venerable Munisara will lead the meditation, and we will then see you back again at 4 o'clock. Okay. 3 o'clock for meditation.